What is up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast, your morning starting pitcher podcast brought to you by PitcherList.com. My name is Jake Crumpler, and today is August 16th. Let's break down every single start from August 15th. Fear is the experience of an unmanifested threat. In fantasy baseball terms, fear is what you feel when you are bombarded with warning signs of inevitable regression. Fear, however, is merely anxiety about the future, a future that only exists in your mind, but it can be a helpful tool when understood correctly. In day-to-day life, that means honestly investigating your thoughts to find the source of the feeling to better understand yourself. The results will tell you whether action or acceptance is required. The process is not too dissimilar when analyzing starting pitchers. Have fears that a pitcher is outperforming their expectations? Take a deep dive and see if there is data to back it up. If there is data to back up regression, change your assessment of the pitcher. And if not, accept this as a new baseline. There's a bit more nuance to it than that. And Reed Detmers is a perfect case study to go about understanding it better. On Saturday, Detmers hosted the Royals, continuing what has been an amazing season as he tossed 8 shutout innings, allowing just 2 hits with no walks and 11 strikeouts. He induced 18 whiffs with 38% CSW across 92 pitches to earn a win. And the Southpaw was awarded a golden goal as he led baseball with those 18 whiffs to earn the gallows pole and earn the King Cole by leading baseball with that 38% CSW. And he lowered his ratios to a 3.78 ERA and a 1.06 whip while increasing his strikeout rate to an elite 29%. What makes Detmers someone who embodies this fear-based analogy? To start, he's long been a volatile pitcher, heavily reliant on a devastating 1-2 punch, a fastball, and a slider. The limited arsenal, in concert with a lack of recent volume, career-long struggles as a starter, zero faith in his club's pitching development or defense, and turbulent command, made his return to the rotation a controversial talking point, only exacerbated by his early 2026 success. Fear crept in as anxiety increased about his ability to maintain his command of a Blake Snell blueprint approach throughout a full season, the inevitable annual disappearance of his signature slider, and the lack of a tertiary offering stepping up to support his fastball or slider when the other one underperformed. But Detmers' downfall never manifested. Now we're at the crossroads where we have to determine whether this is a new baseline with which we have to reach acceptance, or if we should continue to live in fear of an inevitable decline. At this point, I think we've seen enough that we need to change our initial assessment of Detmers. Not only has the Southpaw dominated without pristine command throughout the season, but he's also found enough assistance and trust in his curveball to give him a third pitch when he's not at his best. His changeup has even had moments of waking up to give him a legit right-handed batter nullifier. There have been moments where it looked like Detmers was cooked, lending credence to our anxiety, but he's always emerged stronger than ever. And I think as long as he's throwing plenty of strikes with a Blake Snell blueprint intent and support from a third pitch, he's going to be great, and it's time to enter into a state of acceptance and start Detmers without fear. Now let's see how every other starting pitcher did on Saturday, starting with Sonny Gray in Pittsburgh, tossing 7 innings, no earned runs, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 7 strikeouts. And it's always sunny in Pittsburgh. Doesn't really have the same ring to it. And this start looks a lot better than Gray actually pitched. Sweepers have been the key to his success. And while they induced 5 whiffs and 4 strikeouts, they played pin the tail on the donkey with the zone. And let's just say that that game is not their best party game. He got away with plenty of hittable fastballs in the zone, and he was lucky a typically intimidating Pirates lineup, especially against right-handed batters, didn't make him pay. And whatever, to be honest, it's Giants and then at Miami and then the Mariners moving forward. And I think forecasts call for clear skies ahead for Sonny Gray. Next, we have Michael McGreevy on the north side of Chicago as he tossed 6 shutout innings, allowing 5 hits and 2 walks with 6 strikeouts. And the red M&M is always reliant on batted balls. But when you command as well as he did on Saturday, Koufax isn't needed to produce great results. Because McGreevy commanded so well, he did not need fortunate batted ball luck. He had the Blake Snell blueprint plus Cannibal McSanchez approach cooking against left-handed batters as he kept fastballs upstairs and off-speed pitches down low while mixing 4-seamers with cutters in the upper half of the zone. That allowed him to absolutely dominate against left-handed batters. While against right-handed batters, sinkers kissed the edges of the zone. They were just all around the edges, stealing called strikes, getting weak contact, and they played super well off pristinely located low and away sweepers. We know what to expect from McGreevy moving forward. He's a Toby that we can stream against weak offenses in standard leagues, and we can hold on to him for cromulent yet reliable production in deeper leagues. Next, we have Randy Dobnak in LA against the Angels. He tossed 5 2/3 innings, allowing no earned runs with 4 hits, 2 walks, and 6 strikeouts. And the RD Redemption Tour has been one of the more unexpected storylines of the 2026 campaign. No one can tell me they saw this coming, and if you did, then I don't believe that you're real. Dobnak continued his unreal run with what could be considered his most convincing performance of the year, as he induced a season-high 13 whiffs and 6 punchouts on his way to a Philly, as he was pulled just 1 out shy of a quality start. Everything stayed at the bottom of the zone, and that's been his approach throughout the season. And that allowed changeups to sneak below the zone and beneath the rest of his pitches to induce 7 whiffs and a trio of strikeouts. That's now 6 of his 8 outings with 1 run or fewer. And I don't blame you if you want to Vargas rule this with an easy schedule of the A's and then at Toronto and then the Marlins ahead. Next, we have Will Dion in New York against the Mets. He tossed 4 1/3 shutout innings, allowing no hits with 1 walk and 7 strikeouts. So 4 1/3 no-hit innings from Will Dion, acquired from the Guardians at the trade deadline in the Foster Griffin deal. Dion was untouchable following opener Brad Lord on Saturday. It's unclear if the Nationals are attempting to convert Dion back to starting or if they were just squeezing the most out of him on a night where he was at his best. He's got swatch potential and he throws in the low 90s, but he doesn't have your prototypical bullpen stuff, the high velo, crazy movement stuff, but he does have a funky delivery and a high arm slot, which made him much better in short relief stints than as a starter during his time in the minors. He was striking out boatloads of guys despite averaging 91 miles per hour on that fastball. It's worth keeping an eye on Dion, especially with Lord being considered a starter without being given the leash to look like one. So let's keep an eye on this rotation battle, but it's not worth focusing on so much that you lose track of the important things, like how many waffles you're going to have for breakfast tomorrow. I think I've had 7 over the past 2 days. That's just what happens when you make a batch of batter. Next, we have Simeon Woods Richardson versus the Yankees. 2 1/3 shutout innings, no hits, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. And SWR was fine, if not unremarkable in bulk relief. But I'm more interested in talking about the guy who pitched before him, not Braden Fisher, the opener in this one. No, I'm talking about Ricky Tiedemann. And if you're wondering who that is, I'm getting there. Give me a second. He's a former top Blue Jays prospect. He was actually their number 1 rated prospect back in 2024. And now he's their number 11 prospect, according to MLB Pipeline, as Tiedemann's career has been wrecked by injuries and underperformance. Once one of the most promising southpaws in the minors, I think he was the second highest rated left-handed starter, according to MLB Pipeline, for 2 straight years in 23 and 24. But he's been forced to transition to a relief role to stay on the field. Still just 23 years old, MLB success is not out of the question for Tiedemann, though it's far from guaranteed. In his MLB debut, he showcased a 96-mile-per-hour two-plane four-seamer with lackluster attributes and a promising, well-commanded 81 to 82-mile-per-hour sweeper. Tiedemann may never get a real shot in the rotation, especially this year, and his stuff likely plays better in relief anyway. Next, we've got Jesus Luzardo in Minnesota. He tossed 6 2/3 innings, allowing 1 earned with 7 hits, 2 walks, and 9 strikeouts. Ace is going to ace for Luzardo. Facing solely right-handed batters didn't stop Luzardo from featuring his sweeper as his primary offering. The breaker led his arsenal with 9 whiffs and 40% CSW, while 4-seamers did the only thing we asked them to do, avoid damage. You've probably totally forgotten about Luzardo's slow start by now, as he's recorded a 2.40 ERA, a 1.10 whip, and a 30% strikeout rate across his last 21 starts. Next, we have Joey Cantillo versus his former team, the Padres. Yeah, you probably don't remember that because he never pitched for them in the majors. I forget which trade he was in, but Cantillo was traded in one of the many AJ Preller deals that sent a Padres prospect out of San Diego. But Cantillo versus his former franchise, six innings, one earned, one hit, three walks, and seven strikeouts. And Cantillo's new approach and improved stuff have remained intact across the last few weeks, but the immediate results that accompanied their changes haven't stuck around recently. It was a 1.59 ERA across six starts before a 5.79 ERA across the next five, forcing us to question the validity. I've never struggled with that word. That's crazy. Question the validity of believing in Cantillo 2.0. After Saturday's domination of the Padres, we're back in business. The strikeouts are flowing as curveballs remain his primary pitch. Signature changeups do their thing. Fastballs display increased velocity, and cutters act as the glue holding everything together. And really, what's not to like? I guess heading to Coors next isn't that great, and he does have to do that next. So maybe we avoid Cantillo in Coors next before it's all systems go in Anaheim and then hosting the Blue Jays afterward. Next, we have Jacob Mizorowski in LA against the Dodgers. Six innings, one earned, five hits, one walk with six strikeouts. He induced 17 whiffs with 30% CSW across 98 pitches and helped the Brewers to a win in a likely NLCS preview. And you gotta say, ace is gonna ace for Mizorowski. He is the number one pitcher in baseball after all, and not even the Dodgers could slow down the Miz. This will be a fun postseason rematch if it eventually comes to that. Next, we have Logan Webb versus the Rockies. Six innings, one earned, four hits, no walks, and seven strikeouts. And with Rocky Road, there's only one thing you can do. Eat it all in one sitting. That's one option, but you can also dominate and make fantasy managers increasingly happy. Nothing otherworldly here from Webb, but the classic solid production that makes him one of the most reliable Holly arms in baseball is nothing to be upset about. It was interesting to see him lean so heavily into a Cannibal McSanchez approach against a left-handed batter heavy lineup as he pumped up his four-seamer and cutter usage 17% and 10% respectively. The four-seamer constantly surprised above the zone for eight whiffs and four strikeouts, while cutters worked to jam hitters and prop up his strikeout rate with a 79% mark, his strike rate. Changeups weren't the whiff machines they usually are, but beautiful locations low on arm side allowed them to churn six outs on seven balls in play, while sweeper snuck in the front door for five called strikes. I wonder if this was just a one-night thing or if this is a conscious departure from the sinker that saw a minus 23% usage to just 6% usage. And Webb is well known for being a sinker changeup guy, so very interesting to see him cut back on the sinker. I would not be surprised if he just goes right back to being the guy he was before. That makes a lot more sense than just completely moving away from it at this point in his career after all the success he's had. Next, we have Cam Schlittler in Toronto. He tossed five and a third innings, allowing one earned with four hits, three walks, and seven strikeouts. Ace is going to ace for Cam Schlittler. His RAS pack plus his 87 to 88 mile per hour curveball is a lethal repertoire. He induced 14 whiffs with 31% CSW across 97 pitches, and he lacked the efficiency to complete six frames due to 54% strikes on pitches that weren't labeled sinkers, but I think we'll take this all day. Schlittler will get a chance at redemption with a rematch hosting the Blue Jays this week. Next, we have Jared Jones versus the Red Sox. Five innings, one earned, four hits, two walks, and seven strikeouts. And we needed something to believe in after Jones struggled across his last three starts. And I think this will suffice. He induced a season-high 17 whiffs as his signature four-seamer dominated as usual with eight whiffs, 39% CSW, and 77% strikes, but it was the reemergence of his changeup as a supportive tertiary pitch that really made the difference. Jones has become a fastball slider guy over his past few starts. Maybe it's more of like close to 10 starts after he looked like he was going to expand his arsenal when he made his season debut, tossing a lot more changeups and curveballs. But as he struggled, he's gone more into his famous 1-2 punch. But the reemergence of that changeup is super interesting. He kept it below the zone to left-handed batters to coax five swings and misses, and it was huge in making up for his lack of slider command. The next step will be becoming efficient enough to survive six frames consistently while being capped at 85 pitches. Jones will need more than 51% strikes on secondary offerings to pull that off, and heading to Hollywood next against the Dodgers, he'll need to be at the top of his game to make that a worthy start in fantasy. Next, we have Emerson Hancock in Houston. He tossed 7 innings, allowing 2 earned with 5 hits, 2 walks, and 8 strikeouts, and put this guy in a boat with his twin Will Warren and his contemporary Reed Detmers and shipped them off to the island of pitchers that continue to exceed my expectations despite all of the red flags. Hancock actually did something that he struggled to do all year, something that I've pointed to as a reason that he's not going to continue pitching well, and that's throw some dang good off-speed pitches. I pointed to that as a weakness in his foundation all year as his fastballs have declined. I haven't seen the breakers step up to give him anything else to trust. Well, on Saturday, sweepers were commanded exceptionally down low to right-handed batters for 6 whiffs, and 4 strikeouts, mixing perfectly with arm side sinkers, with 4 seamers handling left-handed batters all by themselves, despite his IVB failing to return to his early season levels. They had 7 whiffs, 42% CSW, and 77% strikes. That's all he needed against lefties was 4 seamers, as the sinker and sweeper combination was great against righties. I'll need to see Hancock maintain the feel for an off-speed pitch more than once, or see his fastball movement return to its April form before I start feeling confident in him again. But you got to keep starting him where you have him rostered, even if he has been a Toby for most of the year. Next, we have Kyle Bradish in Tampa Bay, and then Eduardo Rodriguez and Ryan Gusto and Brady Singer. And we'll talk about all of the rest of the pitchers that pitched on Saturday after taking a quick break here on the Plus Pitch podcast. And we're back. Jake Crumpler here, breaking down every single start from Saturday, August 15th. We'll resume with Kyle Bradish in Tampa Bay. 6 innings, 2 earned, 7 hits, 4 walks, and 3 strikeouts. And this was a dark chocolate cherry bomb, as the results were bittersweet, like a dusty donut. Bradish limited damage by inducing 60% weak contact and keeping the ball in the yard, producing a solid ERA, but awful command kept traffic on the bases all game. Outside of sliders getting a ton of chases to propel it to a 69% strike rate, the rest of his arsenal was not as fortunate, returning a meager 53% strike rate despite a solid 47% zone rate. Blame that on those pitches not fooling anyone, as they combined for just a single whiff and a 15% chase rate. Bradish's ability to work out of jams was spectacular, but it's not a skill we want to rely upon, especially if you like your whip low. Bradish has fanned less than 17% of the batters he's faced across his last 8 starts, and it's getting hard to taste the sweetness in his performances. With the Yankees and Coors sandwiching a start in St. Louis across the next 2 weeks, it may be time to peruse the wire for other options in standard leagues. Those breakers are just so inconsistent, and the heaters so hittable. Next, we have Eduardo Rodriguez in Atlanta. 6 innings, 2 earned, 5 hits, no walks, and 5 strikeouts. And the season-long Vargas rule continues. It was less changeup domination than usual, but that should only make you more confident in Erod's abilities. Even without all 5 of his weapons in immaculate condition, he'll still give you production that's well worth your time in fantasy. This snowball has rolled downhill for so long that there's no stopping it at this point. We're just starting Rodriguez no matter what moving forward. Next, we have Ryan Gusto in Cincinnati. He tossed 4 2/3 innings, allowing 2 earned with 6 hits, no walks, and 6 strikeouts. And Ryan was breezing through the Reds lineup before getting roughed up for 2 homers and a double in the 5th before getting yanked from the ballgame. Not only does Gusto's kitchen sink not have any flavors that get me excited, but he doesn't have a leash long enough to make him worth rostering as a starter, as he struggles to qualify for wins and is definitely not a guy you can count upon for quality starts. Maybe if Gusto had an increased win chance as a bulk reliever, he'd be more interesting, but even then I'd be staying away most of the time. Next, we have Brady Singer versus the Marlins. 6 innings, 3 earned, 8 hits, 2 walks, and 4 strikeouts. And this is fine in a quality start league until you realize it was a very, very poor quality start, as he allowed 10 base runners. And this was a Wonka, as he had just 4 strikeouts and didn't get you a win. So it's a poor ERA, poor whip, few strikeouts, and no win. So there's nothing to take from the start. You don't get anything. And a pair of solo shots and a failure to induce whiffs with his slider put Singer's sinker in a tough spot to carry the load with called strikes and grounders, an approach that is rarely successful or sustainable. You do not want to rely on sinkers needing to get a bunch of called strikes and ground balls that find gloves as your one path to success. And that's sort of what Singer has done throughout his career. He's been a little better recently, but he's been pretty underwhelming in August. Next, we have Ian Seymour versus the Orioles. 6 innings, 3 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 9 strikeouts. From domination to poor quality start, and all it took was a solo shot in the 6th to make it happen. I'll say a careful Icarus for Seymour, as maybe he was pushed a little bit too far. You got to love what Seymour's been doing, though, since a brief stumble sandwiching the All-Star break. His last 5 appearances have produced a 2.51 ERA, a 1.05 whip, and a 31% strikeout rate, as he pulls off the Blake Snell blueprint with 4-seamers and changeups while mixing in sinkers and sweepers to assist versus right-handed batters and dominate against left-handed batters. Seymour needs to be rostered everywhere, especially with a cushy matchup against the Blue Jays on the docket this week. Next, we've got Mackenzie Gore in Sacramento. He tossed 5 2/3 innings, allowing 3 earned with 8 hits, 2 walks, and 5 strikeouts. And not many pitchers survive Sacre Verde. And if you consider this, and I'm not saying I consider this surviving. No, I never said Gore was a member of that select group. I also think he was lucky to allow just 3 runs on Saturday. He stranded runners more efficiently than he should have gotten away with, as he had 10 base runners but allowed just 3 runs. And he produced 16 foul balls on his heater, which probably should have been more damage on balls put in play, which would have made this start look even worse. As a hipster, Gore is always on shaky ground, and it was no more evident than on Saturday. Next, we've got Anthony Kay in Detroit. 5 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, and 4 strikeouts. As a streamable, Toby Kay's someone who we target against bottom half offenses. The Tigers are in the middle of the pack, making it a questionable proposition for success, especially when changeups are failing to fool batters like they usually do, surrendering a trio of hits and a long ball. Kay's been a lot steadier of late with a 3.18 ERA and no more than 3 earned runs allowed across his past 10 starts. But with Hotlanta up next, I think we leave him on the wire. But don't count on success, though, as the Braves are not as intimidating as they were in the first half. They rank 18th in MLB with a 96 WRC plus against southpaws. Next, we've got Troy Melton versus the White Sox. 4 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, and 4 strikeouts. And, well, that's not ideal. And this was the first stumble from Melton since he allowed 4 runs on June 9th. Yeah, he'd gone 9 straight starts with 2 or fewer runs, and 8 of those came with 1 run or less. All we can do is blame Koufax for this one, as Melton got singled out with a ridiculous 529 BABIP. He'll be much more fortunate in Kansas City next, and I don't think this start changed anyone's assessment of Melton anyway. We are auto-starting him moving forward. Next, we've got Sean Manaea versus the Nationals. 6 1/3 innings, 4 earned, 6 hits, 2 walks, and 7 strikeouts. The recipe that propelled Manaea to success in recent starts didn't taste as good as it usually does on Saturday. Let's not ignore the impressive whiff and CSW marks, though. 17 whiffs and 34% CSW from Manaea. 4-seamers were still north of 92 miles per hour, allowing them to shine in the zone for 12 whiffs, 40% CSW, and 79% strikes. That's absolute domination. While sweepers went front door or back foot against right-handed batters for a quartet of swings and misses. That's worked in the past, that approach. But in the past, he didn't serve up a 3-run home run on a back foot slider to Brady House in the 6th inning. Well, it did technically happen in the past, but not the distant past. This start doesn't deter me from trusting Manaea on the south side of Chicago next, even with the White Sox being a club that sort of excels against southpaws. That extra velocity from Manaea on his 4-seamer makes all the difference. Next, we've got JT Ginn versus the Rangers. 6 innings, 4 earned, 8 hits, no walks, and 7 strikeouts. And Ginn was looking right at home through 4 frames. Yeah, he was pitching in Sacramento, but Sacre Verde isn't a very comfortable place to call home, so it was surprising to see him look so good through 4 innings. And it proved to be treacherous again when Ginn served up a run in the 5th before going back out for the 6th to allow 3 more runs, 2 of which came on the Sacramento special, a big old dinger. I'll say careful Icarus for this one, as Ginn was pushed a little bit too far. I'm totally cool starting Ginn on the road in Kansas City next, but I want no piece of him hosting the Twins afterward. Next, we've got Justin Robleski versus the Brewers. Six innings, four earned, four hits, one walk, and six strikeouts. And the downfall of Robleski has been difficult to watch. He's seen his ERA inflate from 2.62 through 17 outings to 3.56 after four straight disasters. Home runs have become a real issue for Robleski. 11 balls have flown over the wall against Robleski during his cold streak after he entered the cold streak with just eight homers on the entire season. Is that expected regression or poor home run to fly ball luck? It's hard to tell, but I remain confident that Robleski's not completely cooked. He threw harder than ever on Saturday, averaging 96 miles per hour with his four-seamer and sitting 88 plus miles per hour with sliders. And as long as he throws 95 plus and pulls off an approach reminiscent of a Blake Snell blueprint with those two offerings while mixing in an expanded arsenal that keeps batters honest, I think Robleski is going to give you a pretty good shot at a win at the very least. Next, we've got Randy Vasquez in Cleveland. Five innings, four earned, seven hits, one walk, and five strikeouts. And Vasquez has recovered the velocity that made him interesting in the spring. It did not come with the whiffs and strikeouts that made it worthy of praise. That was until Saturday when Vasquez induced double-digit whiffs and struck out more than three batters for the first time since June 13th and just the second time since May 9th. And he struggled. He still struggled, pitching in bulk relief of opener Wandy Peralta. Well, it actually went fine for the first four frames until a trio of hits and two runs in the seventh ruined everything. And that's not really a careful Icarus because you got to be able to survive at least five frames when you're at your best. I love Vasquez's cutter sitting 93 miles per hour, but it's not enough to carry an arsenal that is somehow both deep and limited at the same time. Next, we've got Hayden Wesneski versus the Mariners. Four innings, five earned, seven hits, one walk, and six strikeouts. And it's difficult to succeed when your signature pitch fails to find the zone against the handedness against which it excels the most. Against right-handed batters, sweepers landed in the zone never, not once, biting him hard when it came to putting away a right-handed batter with two runners on in the first as he gave up a triple to Victor Robles that scored two runs in the second inning. I can forgive that as I expect Wesneski to generally get it done against right-handed batters, but his left-handed batter approach is what's in question, and most of the damage came from opposite-handed batters on Saturday. Four-seamers were completely uncompetitive above the zone. Changeups didn't fall below the zone effectively, and big looping sweepers aren't the ideal pitch to rely upon as a primary offering against left-handed batters for a right-handed pitcher. Wesneski is a fine Toby in deep leagues at the moment, but I'm going to need to see some improvement from his command to trust him at all in standard leagues moving forward. Next, we've got Grant Holmes versus the Diamondbacks. Three and two-thirds innings, six earned, six hits, three walks, and three strikeouts. And coming off back-to-back outings of six shutout innings, the real estate broker didn't have the favor of Koufax working for him. There was a brief glimpse of curveball and four-seamer support a couple of starts ago for Grant Holmes, but that appears to have been a mirage. Holmes breaks the Huascar rule as the slider is his only good pitch and everything else isn't good enough to support it, and he shouldn't be trusted in standard leagues. You probably don't want a piece of him in deeper leagues either, with the White Sox on the south side next, followed up by the Dodgers. Next, we have Michael Lorenzen in San Francisco. Three and two-thirds innings, six earned, four hits, three walks, and one strikeout. And Lorenzen's ratios are now as big as his muscles. Darn big. And our bread is now as dry as the Mojave Desert. How am I supposed to butter my bread with just one strikeout? Michael Lorenzen has definitely been the worst starter in baseball this year. Second to last, we've got Matthew Boyd versus the Cardinals. Five and a third innings, seven earned, five hits, three walks, and two strikeouts. And this might as well be a chocolate factory because you got a Wonka, which means you got absolutely nothing. A new rival entered the chat as rookie outfielder Joshua Baez took Boyd deep three times to become the first player in MLB history to homer in the first three plate appearances of his career. The long ball has become an issue for Boyd recently. He served up seven dingers in August alone. That's just three starts after he allowed just six home runs in 12 previous starts. I don't think it's a new trend that the kids are doing on TikTok, but I do think we are safe starting Boyd in Seattle up next. And lastly, we've got Connor Prelip versus the Phillies. Five innings, eight earned, eight hits, four walks, and six strikeouts. And I was just starting to regain confidence in Prelip. Then he had to go and get singled out in a fifth frame that culminated in a three-run homer. Prelip had two breakers working here and his fastball didn't get crushed. Maybe he does need that changeup to nullify right-handed batters, or maybe he needs a new pitch to start throwing, like a cutter, if he can't command that slow ball, or maybe he just needs a second chance to prove he's not cooked against the left-handed pitcher prone Padres in San Diego in his next time out. That's every single start from August 15th. On August 16th, my game of the day is Tarek Skubal versus Logan Henderson. That one should be fun, but that'll do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. You can follow me on socials at Jake Crumpler, where I do daily SP streamers and I break down every single start via the pitcher list stats, player cards. I also do the First Pitch Podcast, the In the Pen Podcast, and do some playing time analysis for Baseball HQ. But you can find all of my work over at crumplerbaseball.com. But make sure to head over to pitcherlist.com, where you can find the article that accompanies this podcast, the SP Roundup. And make sure to sign up for PL Plus or PL Pro to gain access to all of the great features we have on the site and to get access to the Discord so you can talk to people like me and other Pitcher List staff over there. But that'll do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. That's every single start from August 15th. We'll talk to you tomorrow.